Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off-limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 439. Come see me do stand-up in cities like Seattle, Minneapolis, Chicago. Well, just those three. Those are the three cities that I'm performing at in December. Go to nerds.com/calendar. Come on out. Matt Myra's going to be opening, so you can pinch his adorably less cherubic face because he's been exercising and eating well. But it'll sort of be like, it'll be two-thirds of the podcast there. And come out and see us. Come out. See us. This episode of Nerds Podcast is brought to you by Fox's Almost Human.
From J.J. Abrams and J.H. Wyman, the producer of Fringe, comes the next evolution of cop dramas.
Is that a good TV dramatic voice, Kyle? I feel like maybe it's not a good enough movie drama voice, but I feel like it definitely will work for TV.
Tonight, an unforgettable Almost Human. I could totally do that. Tonight on Fox's Night at the Movies.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Almost Human from J.J. Abrams and J.H. Wyman. So essentially the story is that it's the year 2048. Every police officer has the latest in weapons technology and an android partner. So this is a robot cop show, and it premieres after the doubleheader Sunday, November 17th on Fox.
Don't be left in the dark. Watch it live Sunday night, Almost Human on Fox.
Now, I could see like I really take it out of your voice after a while. And then you would just be gravelly guy. What? Yeah. It's just weird just hearing you say something. Like, hearing those words come through your beard. It just feels weird to me, Kyle. It just feels weird.
Curse this beard.
You don't have to curse it. You can shave it off. It'd be fun.
No, that was like a 10.
That's okay. Just hit 10 and just do like a thin mustache. Huh?
Evil.
Evil. These are some of my favorite podcasts that we have when I have on Comedy Pals that I've known for ages and ages and ages. Jackie Cation and I started doing stand-up around the same time, did a lot of the same open mics, and I always adored her comedy. And Jackie was a person who put a copy of Harry Potter in my hands in the late 90s, early 2000s, and said, "You're going to read this? I want you to read this. It's Harry Potter. Going to change your life." I think that was kind of the Jackie cadence. And And that's exactly what happened. So Jackie is a hardcore gamer, a lover of sci-fi, has an amazing podcast called Dork Forest, which I've been on and you should absolutely listen to. So please enjoy the Nerdist Podcast number 439 with Jackie Cation.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Speaking of Twitter,
what?
Jackie Cation's here.
Jackie Cation,
hi.
Oh,
we're all on Twitter.
Yeah, we are.
Jackie was one of the Jackie and I have a lustrous history.
Checkered past.
Jackie was one of the first people that I was friends with in the LA comedy scene,
early.
The open mic scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
Didn't we do that weird thing in Westwood?
Yeah, what, Gypsy Cafe?
That's it.
Yeah, there was the...
That was the dumbest venue.
The open mics. The open, yeah. The show was so much fun. I was drunk a lot of the time.
Who wasn't?
But
the audience sadly was. And then they would talk like I remember one time I had to yell at people and say, "What am I, a band?
Yeah.
You gotta pay attention to the whole song, kids."
Yes.
And then
yes, it was there was a really remember Robin Jones and Mary Keith O'Brien.
Yes, I do. Mary Lowe these many years.
Who booked the Friday show, but then also that I ended up booking the show with them, and then they started coming,
right.
And then they also would pop into Vance Sanders' Tuesday night show at the Gypsy.
Oh right.
There was one this actually happened during the show, but they introduced hookahs to the Gypsy Cafe. So all
right.
These
long time coming. Name's
all these
Gypsy.
All these very wealthy Persian kids would come in these like insane like S class white Mercedes. It was
right
and
just reeking of fake Giorgio cologne.
And they didn't. I don't think it's racist or anything to say this. I don't mean this anything in any disparaging way. They did not like to. They did not want to have to be quiet for the show.
No, that's ageist. That isn't racism.
That was teenagers.
You're like, you crazy kids.
Yes.
Get your shit together.
But yeah. One time, there was a table of kids, and they were
because they're high school kids. They're not even college.
I think they were high school / college. But,
yeah.
But and so there was a table.
They don't go to college.
And they were
guys.
Talking. But they were.
There's the line.
They were talking at the table very loudly, almost kind of defiantly, you know, for the show. And then Robin kept saying like, "Hey, could you please, you know, like guys, keep it down. We're doing the show." Like he tried to, you know. And then one of the kids goes, "This guy thinks he's funny. He's no Jay Leno, but he thinks he is," or something like that.
Good writing.
And then, but then Robin imitated the guy's accent back to him, and he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, bro. Are we not funny enough for you? Are we not funny enough for you?" Like that. And I was like, oh, shit. A line was just crossed in the other direction. And the kid looked at him for a second, and I was right next to their table, and he looked at his friends, and I swear to God, he said, "And they wonder why we become terrorists." And and then they all laughed. And I was like,
that's pretty funny.
And it was very shortly after that.
I don't mind that at all. That's the funniest thing the kid said.
Very shortly after that, the show moved to the Westwood Brewing Company and away from Hookah Village.
Then it died.
Well, it just recently died. It lived on for a very long time.
Oh, right, because he was holding the Tuesday open mic there?
July was the last show because the Bruco got sold, and so it was changing.
Sold from underneath it.
But you know, I realized very quickly, like, you're one of those people that was like, oh, yes, Jackie is nerd, folks. She understands the things that I say.
Oh, yes.
And you were the one who introduced me to Harry Potter, which I believe was right around Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, I think it might have been, I thought it was, yeah, that sounds
I think
right.
It was Goblet.
Might have been the one right before that. What is it? How does it go? Philosopher's Stone? Let's do the British.
Well, you're doing the British version. Yeah. You're doing that. You're doing the Philosopher's Stone, Chamber of Secrets. Then
yep.
I think it's Goblet of Fire.
It isn't. It's it's
Prisoner of Azkaban. Then Goblet of Fire.
Four
and then
is
Deathly
Goblet.
And then Deathly Hallows.
No, Deathly Hallows is 7.
What happened to the Order of the Phoenix?
Order of the Phoenix is 6.
5 is guys, if there's one thing I've
this
learned.
This is a fail.
The Half-Blood Prince.
Yes. Half-Blood Prince.
Yes.
How could we have forgotten Snape?
How could we have forgotten Severus?
More Snape. That's what I always think whenever I see a movie. More Snape.
But you introduced me to the series after only
a
few books.
Which I thought was interesting, yeah.
And
so then you were in for the next one, and then like you were in the waiting game with the rest of us, right?
Yes, it was very fun to catch up on the three that I read.
Yeah.
Like, because you know. And of course, they get progressively longer.
Right, because people become progressively unwilling to edit her.
Mm-hmm.
As they're like, no, I'm sure every word is a genius word. I'm sure it's amazing, JK.
It's a $1 billion. Billion dollars later,
I would have invoked possibly line veto. Just someone just to go through with a pen and just go, these are suggestions. You take them, you leave them. I'm just saying this is slightly redundant. How about 3 months of camping in the last
3 months of camping, which not only did they not edit out of the book, but they were like, and let's just keep this in the movie, too.
Right.
Of them just moving the tent.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to move the tent again. It's going to be a great scene. Poof. And you're like, we all have a green screen. We could all do this. We could all make it poof.
Absolute love. So
I
owe you for that. And I also have to atone for the time that I told you to tell the story on stage when you...
I am consistently taking bad advice like that. What did I say?
You told me a story once about how you met an old guy at a bar.
Oh, that made it onto my album. There's no way you should apologize for
that. Okay, good. Because I thought the first time I saw you do it, it didn't go well. And you were like, yeah, I don't know. It just freaked him out.
But that entertained me enough for me to write it tighter. And so that is the old guy on It's Never Gonna Be Bread, available on iTunes. Here's the thing. When I was 23, I met, I went drinking. Right? As you do when you're 23, you say to yourself, I'm going to go look for a video game and a beer. And then all of a sudden it's 11 p.m. as a 23-year-old.
And you grew
lady.
Up in Minnesota?
This is in Milwaukee. I grew up in Milwaukee. I was out of Milwaukee, but I was living with my sister in Milwaukee and I was walking distance from her house. And at 11 o'clock at night, I was friends with the career drunks, right? Who were holding up the bar. And one of them was a 72-year-old gentleman that at 11 p.m. said, Do you want to go somewhere else? And I was like, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Because there's more booze there.
I guess, is there booze there? Then that'll be fine. And so we go, and then it's 2 in the morning, and then he starts hitting on me. And now I don't even know where we are, because we got into his Cadillac. Cadillac excitement.
Did you die?
I did not die. He did not find a lime pit, and and he did not circle around looking for a lime pit for hours. And instead, so we're in he starts hitting on me at like bar time. This is the story, right? Obviously. So... he's hitting on me, and I'm like, oh, gross, old guy hitting on me. And then he goes, starts telling me how sad he is and how long it's been and how lonely he is. And I was like, I could fuck him. It wouldn't kill me, right? It's not going to kill me. He's sad. He's lonely, right? And so he puts his hand. Oh, wait, no, I put my hand on his thigh. On his thigh. At no time do I touch the little veteran of the big war, which is one of my favorite jokes in that bit. But it's all true. And then this genuinely happened. He turned to me and he said, thank you, and he came.
Right there.
Right there. Right then.
Nicely
never realized.
Done.
I know it. Never realized how powerful
I was. Got to give props to the 72-year-old guy for being able to make it happen at that.
Well, and the thing is, and then I would love to end the story there, but he had to drive to his house so he could change his pants.
Of course.
Right. And then I'm wandering around his weird attic.
Who know that that you had this magic power, that you were the Roma Downey of hand jobs.
Who that is? Who's Roma?
Touched by an angel.
Oh, nice work, nice one, well played.
Yeah.
And yes, and then but the thing is so he's and there's no beer or booze anywhere, so I walk into the night at 3:30 in the morning, going, I wonder what's going to happen to me.
And I
had sex with an Ethiopian gentleman later that evening.
That's nice.
Later that evening,
later that morning, I met a graduate student from UWM, and he was like, "Do you want to have sex?" And I was like, "Yeah." Yeah, I've been wanting to sort of have sex for the last couple hours. And all I remember is that we used a condom, because you should always use a condom, folks. You never know how fertile you're going to be.
Really? It wasn't 23. It wasn't Injera? Were they just full?
No, there was no. There was a...
I've been on an Ethiopian food kick, which Chloe turned me on to, and it's fucking phenomenal.
It's great.
You go to the one place, the Fairfax Ethiopian district?
There's like six.
There's six in a row, though,
yeah.
Right?
They're all in a row, and they're all good in their own way. I like Rosalind's because they have yambals.
In their own way.
They are. So like, they each kind of have their own thing. They
each
sort of have their own thing and their own way of presenting it. And,
okay.
I think our favorite is, what's it called? It's in Brooklyn. Our favorite one in the entire country is called Gannett, and it's in Brooklyn. And
with
it's
Gannet?
I believe it's Ghenet. I believe it's Gannett.
Okay.
I think you should have said my favorite one that we've been to. Because you can't just make a blanket statement. It's your favorite one in the entire country.
So far.
I think that's implied, though. My favorite one means my favorite one that I've been to. I didn't say the best one in the country. I said my favorite one.
Have you been to a better one? Have you been to Gannett? And then you got something to throw down in Seattle?
I don't eat the open food.
It's phenomenal.
Oh, because
you eat it with the injera, and basically the you get the bread, and then
no,
you
it's the bread.
You tear it off, and then you scoop it up with your hand and eat it, and it's so.
You know the rule?
What?
With Ethiopian food, you're not supposed to touch your lips.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen.
Right, right. I don't know how they
do it. I'm a lip eater.
And what happens is it's part of my mouth. And and especially if I'm eating with my hands.
That's where everything...
I'm just going to be shoving it into my joke hole.
Yeah, but I have to tell you that... with no other... Ethiopian food is the only cuisine where I feel bad if I don't finish everything.
Yes.
Or when they come to the table and you're like...
I can't. But you have somewhere you can send this?
And I feel so... I'm always overeating, which... the injera, it just, it gets into your stomach and then it just woof. And
it's
then
like
it
one
just,
of those dinosaurs you put in water.
Yeah. But it basically, it's so delicious when you, but you start eating it really fast.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're just like, oh, I'm really, oh
too
no.
Full, too full.
There's a great one in Austin. We've been to great ones in Portland, Seattle, Canada, like everywhere.
Have you been to Minneapolis?
Minneapolis is a huge Ethiopian population,
right.
But I have not been there since I discovered my love of Ethiopian
food.
There you
go. Well, next time you go, you are going to be in a heaven of Ethiopian food.
I absolutely will. I was supposed to be at Acme in September, but I had to cancel it because of work.
Oh, life to lead.
So
I was just there. I went to open mic on Monday, and it didn't go well. It didn't.
Why?
I know it. It went fine. I am. Quite honestly, allow me to make an announcement. I'm used to doing really well right now. I'm in a really sweet spot. I got some hubris going on. Here's what's happening. I'm doing very well. And so when I don't get carried off stage by people and then made it canonized, it turns out I get grumpy. I get a little grumpy.
You know what's kind of fun about it is that basically... If you're a solid road comic, going and doing an open mic can be a little bit like trying to get through the Wipeout course, where you're just like, oh, I just fell off the wet ball into the mud. But before, I don't
right.
know.
You know, I bury a new bit in and amongst the gold, then I can just sort of coast. I can milk the goodwill of the audience and get out of it. Open mic, still doing seven. Still just got out. And I'm working on two new six-minute bits, which means Acme Comedy Company, I went over. Jackass.
Can I tell you that has been, since I've been doing the road a lot, it's become harder and harder to do like a 7 to 10 minute set because... You're so used to building your set in the context of all the stuff around it.
Yep.
And so when you have 7 minutes, a 7 minute set is totally different because it's either just a series of quick jokes or...
I don't think you people understand. I'm Socrates.
It's crap.
There's a journey. We are on a journey, my friend.
It's Socrates. Oh, I see. I'm getting the light. Cogito ergo sum. Cogito ergo sum. Thanks for being here. You can't... In 7 minutes, if you have a bit that needs context, it's very difficult to let the audience know who you are in the first part of it so that you can justify the bit that you're about to do.
Right. And so what you were forced to do is to be funny right from the beginning and then all the way to the end.
Yeah.
That is, it's one of, and the other thing is I've been doing, in between doing the road, I do a lot of LA sets, and more in LA, people are like, oh, let's take the journey with Jackie. What's going to happen? And so... They're forgiving before I begin. A regular open mic audience in Minneapolis, that's my home club, right? So they kind of know who I am. They're going to need it to be funny. They're going to need some jokes.
They're going to want some comedy in there.
Some punchlines, more than the three in 7 minutes.
Just make fun of the last comic's closer.
Oh!
And then make fun of the next comic's hairdo.
Well, I know, I mean, like, I know...
Cy Amundsen.
I know some people who, you know, in this sort of the Comic-Con circuit that have been, had some success doing sets in front of the Comic-Con crowd. And then if they ever drift outside and do an actual open, like an actual
just a regular,
show, a regular
open
show.
Mic?
It's they're like, what happened? I'm like, well, because...
Your 5 minutes on Phantom
because
is not going to kill.
You're you know, when you're performing in front of your audience...
What is the Comic-Con circuit?
Well, it's like...
Comic book. There's comic... I did AnimeCon this year in Convergence, where they flew me in to do a live Dork Forest and a stand-up show, and they were the greatest audiences
in
the world.
Yeah, they're the best.
And yeah, they get everything.
Yeah, the first time Mike Furman and I... We'd been on the road doing clubs and struggling, and then we did, you know, American Dinosaurs and Pie, the song about Pie, and then El Corazon at Comic-Con, like, you know, 6 years ago or something.
Right.
And it was just like the room shook, and we're like, oh, you're supposed to find your audience and then perform. You know, normally the process is you do the road and, you know, you shed people along the way that aren't into what you do, and then the next time you go back, it's more and more of your people until eventually it's just all your
people.
Or
you give up and you get this really awesome chunk about bros.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever.
Or you can just go to the water source where your audience is and then perform and then perform for them, and it's just such
a
different
experience.
Is that
why we mostly do live shows around Comic-Cons?
Well, no, it's mainly because it's...
You're there anyway doing 70 panels.
Well, yeah, that, and it's not as expensive to... it's really expensive for us just to go into a town and do the podcast without any outside promotion or anything.
I've been doing more and more of those. Like, I just did one in Portland, and I'm doing one in San Francisco in a couple of weeks. And it's, I don't make any money. It's all fine. But I want to do them so bad that I'm just like, no, I want to go. And then, so what I do is I usually do a live Dork Forest, and then I do a stand-up show. And for both of them, you can pay $10 each, or you can pay $15, and then if I fill the room,
deal.
You know,
it's a bargain.
Well, it's also smarter for us to do live podcasts around cons because there are, you know, 50,000 people clustered.
Yes,
and it's not like just going in on a random night where there's nothing. It basically, we're putting the trough near the herd.
That's it. And because people at those conventions, they're normal Americans. They're regular people. So they get all your bro jokes, but they also get your weird Horcrux joke, right? I mean, you're just like, I'm building a tent over here, and so I'm going to fill it up with my...
Now, the Horcrux that you had to create by doing all the bro jokes at all of the clubs around the country.
Exactly. It's going to be gorgeous.
Split your soul 7 times.
Yes.
By killing on stage.
On stage.
See where this is all
boom.
Jesus back around. Christ.
Well, I was going to tell you that the
did I just Alpha 3-9 Matt? His forehead is still resting on the microphone.
I was going to tell you the last advice I took of what bit to do on stage, and it worked just as well, but means that I got to just keep writing it because it's great. Is Andy Kindler? Andy Kindler. I asked him if he had ever seen A Man Called Horse. And he is age appropriate. I saw it because my father loves cowboy movies. It is a non-racially sensitive Richard Harris Indian movie, cowboy and Indian movie from 1970. Richard Harris, Man Called Horse. Richard Harris would like to be an Indian. The Indians are like, yeah. Anyway, so they hang him from his pectoral muscles, and it's on the poster where he's hanging on these metal hooks from his pectoral muscles. And I was like, you've seen that movie, right? And Andy was like, no, I haven't seen it, but I think you should do the joke anyway. I think the people have seen it. I just think I'm the one who's never seen it. Has anyone seen that movie?
No, so, I'm aware of it, but
so
I've
you're
never
taking
seen
reference
it.
Advice from the guy who makes the most specific references in comedy.
I ate it. The joke so did not work, and I get off stage and I'm telling the story, and Greg Fitzsimmons goes, "Wait, you took advice of what to say on stage from Andy Kindler?" And I was like, "Noted, yeah." And
is, you know, I think we can all agree one of our favorite comics to watch
of
perform,
course.
But
oh,
his
God,
references are very. Very specific.
Very specific.
Especially when he starts going down these deep industry dives.
It's a giant rabbit hole that he wallows in. And then he crawls out of because he's been doing stand-up comedy so long. And he has the skills, he has developed the skills to get out of that hole. This one, the golden retriever of stand-up comedy, Jackie Cation. I just keep talking. I'm just like, no, you like me. You like me, right? Come on. And then here's another joke. Here's a different one. But it's a breast cancer joke. It's really good stuff. Man Called Horse. You're going to see it on the next album. It's going to be awesome.
Fantastic.
It's going to be sweet.
But you you also were one of the people that made me feel like it was okay to start talking about you know, all the kind of nerdy shit that I wanted to talk about because you had the about calling the helpline for
The Nintendo, the Final Fantasy Legend.
Yeah, the Final
joke?
Fantasy about killing God and all the.
Yeah, I get so many guys who are like 25 or 26 who come up to me and like, man, when I was 14, I saw you do that joke on Comedy Central and it changed my life. You were the first one to do a joke about video games. And I was like, yeah, that game changed my life. It took away 8 months of my life. And then $37 from the Nintendo helpline. Mm-hmm. And
was that your favorite?
It was my favorite game. It's the greatest game. It was the old gray brick of a great Game Boy, right? And it's I always thought it was Final Fantasy 1, but I've been corrected many times. Many, as you can imagine. Final Fantasy 2, I'm told. And it's super hard. I mean, they wouldn't make a game that hard.
Well, you had to
hard.
Call a helpline. Of course it was hard.
But they wouldn't even, I mean, like, it's sort of based on, like, they're like Zelda games because you wander around the world and you figure out what the hell you're supposed to do.
It's like an open world RPG kind of
Yeah, and it was huge. It was 5 different worlds and the worlds were huge. And it was black and white and it was pixelated and it was And the storyline was, you know, like initially you had to like get the sword, the shield, and the
crown.
And
you walk from location to location, and then you get ambushed in between, like right. in the forest, and all of a sudden you're in this melee.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's boss. I mean, it's normal video game. And then there's a boss fight. Let me explain how video games work. What happens is you fight this one guy,
what?
And then you keep walking, and there's another guy. And anyway, so but it was genuinely the funnest game, and I have tried to replay it again, and I had to give up. I was like. I just played a game on my iPad called Middle Management of Justice, and it's an iPad game. You know how most iPad games, you could play like 5 or 6 times, and then you have to either give them money,
yeah.
right.
or you have to wait several hours to reload, yeah. like Candy Crush or Pop a Pear or whatever. This thing, there, you can keep going. You can continue to Farmville tap on things forever. I could have died of starvation. Just a skeleton getting ready to tap a Middle Management of Justice. You were training... superheroes to fight and it's there's a lot of upgrading, there's a lot of maintenance of the, you upgrade the office, things are happening. It's a fun game.
It's and your husband is actually a
game designer.
He designs games. Yeah.
He's the only person because I was playing 6 hours a day for 8 days until I beat it. And the only person in the world would be someone who makes video games who would come up at like day 5 and go, I'm so psyched to see you playing games so much. I lost a gig. I didn't respond to the text message. It was a nice gig. I was playing.
I think maybe your middle management skills might need to be aimed a little bit
more real time.
Yeah.
Real RL.
Yeah, yeah. You started the story by telling us how much the game didn't cost you.
Right.
It actually probably cost you about $5,000.
Yeah. Good night. Excellent point, Matthew. Yes. Excellent point. Noted.
So I'm doing this gig tonight. Should I upgrade body armor? No. It's just stand-up jokes.
Last time that happened, the last gig I missed because of a video game was StarCraft. And,
oh, God. StarCraft buried me for a while. I've not played StarCraft 2 because
no.
I just don't want to lose that significant part of my life.
Right.
The Zerg.
There's a certain time when you just have to step away from all of those, entire platforms. I loved
Warcraft and Warcraft 2 so much. Because they're the kinds of games where, and you and I have the same alcoholic brain, which is it's very like when I'm out doing other things that
you
I'm supposed to be
Ethiopian
doing,
guy too?
And I fuck the 72-year-old, I fuck an Ethiopian guy,
72-year-old guy, and then there was a nice.
I just
Ethiopian
mashed him up.
Dude.
He was a 72-year-old Ethiopian guy. Like, let's just streamline
17?
This.
17,
72.
Okay.
So I would be out doing things that I needed to be doing to maintain my life, and still be thinking about. You know, raiding the mine to get all the gold to upgrade the barracks, and you know, and then StarCraft came along, and it was like, oh my God, it's that, but with space stuff. You know,
did you ever try Myst?
Yes, and Riven, the sequel to Myst.
You know, here's my problem: I never really played Myst correctly.
Fucking
I spent the entire time
games.
In the library.
Oh, yeah.
Like weeks and weeks reading everything in the library because I thought for sure the secret would be in the book. It turns out it's a video game, Jackie. Do you remember Matt Weinhold's old joke about computers? He used to do this joke about computers because he didn't have one for many years. And his friends were like, you got to get one. You got to get one. That's how old the joke is.
Yeah.
Because he said, have you been outside? The graphics are great. And in a video game, leave the library.
Yeah, but Myst was like that first CD-ROM game where... Everything was almost photorealistic and beautiful.
Oh, the graphics
just like
were
this
amazing.
That utopian empty puzzle world.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking loved Myst.
It was so great. It was I heard Jared Logan do a bit about Myst.
Really?
Recently. Yeah, it was the longest thing about how Myst, it was the worst premise ever, because whoever you helped, two people were trapped in eternity in a book. Spoiler alert, Myst, a game from 17 years ago. Anyway.
There was one of the Zork games was very much like Myst, and I can't remember what it was called, but they did a CD-ROM Zork title.
Right.
It was before, maybe it was right... Before or after the Zork the Grand Inquisitor, and I think it was Activision, but I can't fucking remember what it was called, but it was very much that you're in this weird utopia, this weird world, and it's right. empty. I used to have nightmares like that where I would just be in some weird world and right. there was no anyone else.
Right, no people, nothing.
Sounds great.
Just a bunch of puzzles to solve.
I occasionally have nightmares where I'm trying to do stand-up and everyone's deaf and I don't sign. I'm not even kidding. It's like, guess who needs another thing to do in life?
You just described the open mic you performed.
No, I swear to God, this gun control joke, there's something here.
Come on, you guys. And then you start getting flustered because you get spoiled. When people say, do you bomb? And you go, you know, bombing at a certain point,
it doesn't
really happen that often because you have enough skill sets that even if stuff's not landing, you go, okay, well, I'll just...
Go somewhere else.
Pull this other trick out of my sleeve, or I'll just go into the crowd or whatever. And so it's very rare that you will, where it's just like the audience is just not having a bar of you.
Yes. And yes, I don't eat it. Granted, it could happen. It could happen at any time. But I mean, usually I can go somewhere to milk the goodwill of the audience at the very least.
I mean, you know, it's just sort of the benefit of having done comedy for 15 years is that you just start to figure out how to, like, you know, roll with the
punches. And then you redefine what bombing is. Because quite honestly, I got off stage and everyone was like, oh, that new stuff, there's a lot there. That's nice. And I was like, I got to go. I got to go be depressed until my next set. And it's just talk about alcoholic thinking. Talk about ridiculous thinking. Oh, I did, by the way, I did a Nerdist, Janet Varney's JV.
Yeah, JV Club.
Yeah, and she does this, and I had never played MASH or whatever, where she asks you, like, what would be the food and drink that you could, if there were no repercussions, what you would drink and eat. And I was like, well, clearly chicken, and then booze, and then third one, you can fucking pick it. I just want all the booze in the world and some chicken.
And booze.
Chicken
do you
and
still
booze.
Do you still wish you could drink?
When I'm not thinking about what I was like when I drank, yes. You know, like when people are having a beer, or when people they're like, well, we're going to go to this cool, it's going to be like booze and cruise. I was
right.
like, oh, wow, that'd be something. Except for, you know, I was, I would love to be a...
a regular person.
A regular person who could drink. But then I never was. And even when I was drinking, I didn't want to be a regular person who drank. I wanted to drink everything and then work heavy machinery and get arrested.
Did that happen?
Yes. Oh, a couple of times. Just a couple of times.
Did you drink? Your goal was to get drunk?
Oh, yeah. From the get.
You too?
From age 9.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess...
Whether consciously or...
I mean, I don't think it...
Let me interview the two alcoholics.
Well, hang on.
What do you think? What do you think?
Well, I don't think it was that I was like...
I'm asking.
I want to get really drunk. I think it was, I don't want to stop. I think it was more from the other...
And what part... What was it that made you go, I don't want to stop drinking? Like, what? Because
that is a mystery.
Well, yeah. I know.
If you're looking at it.
I know what it was.
You guys have both tackled them. You tackled your demons. You can talk about it.
Tackling is an ongoing process.
Yeah, all right.
You're basically locked. You're basically locked like a Grecian sculpture of two uncircumcised wrestlers in the dirt. is basically what it feels like. But
wow.
But
That's weird. I always picture circumcised wrestlers.
But I think
they were not circumcised.
I think ultimately. It wasn't so much like, I want to get drunk. I think a lot of it has to do with being able to control the environment. So no matter where you are, you can drink and control how you feel. So I think a lot of it for me was a reaction to not being in control, not feeling like I was in control of things and needing to control them. The same way that, you know, if someone has an eating disorder, they are controlling, if their lives feel crazy, and I don't mean to speak for people with eating disorders, but this, from what I understand, it's very similar to alcoholism in the sense that if I can't control everything that's going on out there, I can control what I'm putting into my body. And that's a weird way to sort of feel control.
Like you are controlling
in a chaotic world.
Yeah.
Even if it harms you,
right.
you still are controlling the outcome of the experience. And I think the other side of it for me was not claiming responsibility for any type of emotional state. Like, if I got very happy, I would drink. If I got very sad, I would drink. It was not having to deal with any extreme emotion, which I'm a very hypersensitive person, so I feel very extreme emotions.
You drink the way I eat.
Well, I mean, I don't know. If you feel that way.
We're not here to judge
your eating
habits. No, guys,
please, go ahead.
And what I call, like, the thing is because I don't drink right now, and I try not to eat emotionally, uh, I, uh, I make an announcement to my loved ones. Hey, my Asperger's hump is acting up. I gotta get the hell out of here. And because I don't know how to, because I have emotional I don't know how to have, my social skills are not excellent. And no, I don't think anybody's really are. Yeah. I mean, I don't know a lot of people who are good. I know some people who are good at it, and those
God bless.
People. Yes, when I think of a guy who's good at it, and my favorite Todd Glass, I was in UCB New York, and you might have been there for that one, where he made Rory Scovel close. He was supposed to close, but he said he didn't want to. He made Rory Scovel close, so Rory's up, and Todd is heckling him from the side, yeah. And he won't stop heckling him
when he was supposed to go last.
Yeah, and then and Todd yells, "You can do my closer if you want, Rory. You can do my closer." And Rory pauses, and then he just goes, "You know, Todd, I'm actually not comfortable saying the N-word." Oh. And then Todd is just jumping up and down going, "Now people are going to think I do a joke. Now people are going to think I do a..."
And just, I can just imagine Rory's like, "Well, now, Todd..."
It was so great.
Fucking funny.
It was the greatest response.
But so for you too, it was some sort of social anxiety.
Yeah, well, and the thing is what the literature claims is that it is an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And so what I understand with most addictions, you know, like, it's what I also do addictively at this time is I reread. I read books. Okay. I read books, and then I reread them, and then I reread them. And if I'm feeling any sort of social anxiety, I'm like, "I'll be right back. I'm going to go read 20 pages," and it could be Harry Potter. Yeah. It can be a Cage Baker book. It can be a romance novel. It can be William Gibson. It doesn't matter what it is. I've just had to have read it before, and I just returned to sort of a safe space in a book. And that... it could be worse, you know. I mean, there could be worse addictions. Rereading, yeah. Not the worst addiction.
If you're going to have one.
Right.
I mean, I sort of, you know, I was like, well, if I know I'm programmed to have these types of obsessive behaviors, I might as well do something constructive with
right.
it and not, I mean, it's better than, I mean, obviously the goal would be, well, you don't have any obsessive behaviors at all.
Everything in moderation.
But
how lovely would that be?
I don't know if it really, I don't know if I, for me, I don't think it really works that way.
I'm not wired that way.
So, you know, it's...
God, I wish I exercised too much sometimes.
No, huh? You don't, because then you'd really fuck your body up.
It's true, true.
Anything too much is going to fuck your body
yeah.
up. And I never miss the drinking. I really don't, because it just, I know, I think it's important when you have a weakness that you respect its how powerful it is.
Yes.
And
if you think it through.
If you respect its power, then I think you're less likely to do it, because I go, well, yeah, I could, you know, like when we were on a road trip, if we're driving, you know, if we were in Scotland.
Oh,
I was
right.
Like, oh my God. There's so many there are pubs here older than our country.
Right.
And, you know, and they're charming. And wouldn't it be great just to go fucking
yeah.
hang out and be in this old pub and kick back a pint? And then I go, yeah, and then I fast forward to like 30 beers from that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I just know that it wouldn't stop there. And
right.
so
it,
I go.
It wouldn't be the sort of bucolic experience that is on a commercial that you're like.
Yeah, so I know that...
That's what I always think it's going to be going in. I'm going to be a lady. I'm going to have a nice glass of wine.
No, it doesn't work that way. No. And so I know that it won't work that way. And so rather than saying, oh, I can't do that, I go, well, I know what this will lead to, and I choose not to do that because
right.
I don't want to lose everything that I have in my life.
So you think logically.
Well, I try my best
to.
Which, yeah. which, by the way...
Constant vigilance. Mad-Eye Moody.
Which, by the way, like, writing the scripts to run in your brain at the moments of weakness to kick off, creating that sort of emotional macro in your brain
yeah.
is... it takes work. But
yeah.
then at a certain point, it becomes a habit, and then you just sort of like... And
right.
then at a certain point, it becomes so fast that you barely realize that you've processed it, but it happens, but it's just at such a fast...
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it only comes up, sneaky sometimes, and it'll come through a weird door.
10 years for me in October. What about you?
15.
Yeah.
In September.
Oh,
nice.
Someone's better at it than you.
Damn it!
Yes, yes. Better at it. Because it is a competition.
Isn't it? Everything's a competition. That's what I was told by my dad, which is probably why I eat.
Right. Exactly.
I think one aspect to obsessive behavior, and if you feel like you are, you eat and you can't stop yourself.
Well, luckily, I've been able to sort of curb it, but
yeah. But if you do feel that way, then I think some of it can be a control issue, and it's just like
I need to be
this.
In control of something, and yeah,
I'm guessing.
You could find something. I mean,
need to control the Sprinkles curbside pickup. Like I need it to be at a certain time.
Well, it's just that you know we. It's so difficult to control emotional outcomes with the rest of life, you know, especially in this business. And you feel like, you know, no one ever really feels 100% stable, and someone could come along at any minute
right.
and go, you're fired, or you shouldn't be doing
you're
that.
No longer
and they,
cool.
And they would take away the, you know, like they would get the jump on you emotionally. But you know, if you're drinking or if you're eating or whatever, and in that moment, you know exactly how that thing is going to make you feel. You know exactly what's going to be produced chemically in your brain by ingesting that thing or taking that thing. Then that you're control that that's you controlling your environment.
That was the worst part of Last Comic Standing, because I did that's dumb game. Andy said, "You're right, you've played this game twice. You've never won, and you don't enjoy playing it. Please do not play it again." And my husband, everything's a game. So, but the worst thing about the reality show that is Last Comic Standing is that there is someone with a camera for 6 hours a day pointing at you, and the segment producer behind them going, "What do you talk about? You know, what do you think? What's your life going to be like if you don't win?" 30 to 7 million times a day.
Yeah.
And the first 7,000 times they say it, you can joke. And you could say, "Well, turns out I'm going to Tucson next week. It'll be fine. I'm going to go do stand-up comedy. I got an open mic on Thursday. I'm going to go do this weird coffee shop." And you can joke about it and go, "Well, I'll still get to do stand-up comedy." Because you will. You will still get to do stand-up comedy, whether anyone cares or not. And but the billionth time they ask you, your head starts spinning. And you're like, I wonder what will happen if I don't get this. Will my life be over? What's going to happen? And then you want to eat a sandwich, or you want to, drink some booze, or you want to go fuck somebody, or you want to go spend some money, or you know, I mean, whatever your addiction is, right?
Well,
I thought I'd bring it to a screeching fucking.
No. I was thinking about different points that you made in there, and which one I was going to.
Talk about
because I guess you know, I was just kind of localizing it to booze and food, but it is any kind of sexual thing or any kind of
money thing
or
those
any
are
kind
other
of
people's
obsessive collecting of something like anything where you are controlling the experience because you know the emotional outcome is it's a very simple if A then B type of scenario.
Right. That's all you got.
But
you think it's all you've got, right? You think all I can do is have another beer. All I can do is go buy those shoes. Or all I can do is find some woman to have sex with me next to that dumpster. And or whatever your journey is.
Or a combination of all of them.
Right. With her in new shoes.
That's right. And outside the bar
exactly.
that you're drinking at.
And she's like, "Don't get that dumpster juice on me.
Fuck me on that donut shop."
But that's what I call my cum. It's dumpster juice.
Really, my pussy's called the donut shop.
Oh my God, this is great.
What? You guys, a webcomic.
we'll call it Sprinkles.
Oh, delicious.
Oh yeah, Sprinkles cupcakes. Really good.
Fantastic.
Their
vanilla cupcake is the single greatest item on the planet Earth.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Well, now I want that.
Yeah,
where the
you
hell
should
is
want it.
It.
It's the Grove. You can go to the Grove. They're opening a whole Sprinkles bakery where they're going to introduce more than just cupcakes on La Cienega.
This episode sponsored by Sprinkles.
If Sprinkles would love to sponsor me, I would gladly take a gift card.
Right. You would do it in trade?
Yeah, sure.
Is that the best idea?
What, to take a gift card?
Well, if you're trying to not like
possibly
when I was trying to get drinking under control.
Yeah,
someone was like,
"You didn't want a Budweiser gift card?"
I did not want a Budweiser gift card. I mean, I don't know.
So a Sprinkles gift card, maybe not.
The one the thing about eating though is like, you know,
you gotta take that that devil out three times a day, man.
Yeah, you do it anyway. And then there's, you know, if you build in your certain whatever plan you have that cheat day or meal, if you will. There's always the option for a cupcake. But what I got to try to do is not get a dozen.
Well, the hardest thing, which I actually, I do believe, well, from my point of view, I think it would be harder to, if I had the eating disorder gene as opposed to the drinking gene, I think the eating disorder one would be harder because... drinking is not something you have to do, but eating is something you have to do to survive.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly having to engage in something. You're right. You're standing in the waters of your addiction.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're not supposed to wade too deeply, but you're right there.
My
right.
body looks like your 2006 liver felt.
What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? You just gotta just.
I don't know. Just
read a book.
Seven,
read a book.
Well, that's why I think that's why I think, you know, when like people, it's
that's
not
what I do now.
It's the, you know, whatever the addictive personality, whatever the addictive trait is a byproduct of what the underlying emotional issue is, and so that's why.
And we just exploit. Oh, that's why.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that's why just quitting something doesn't fix the problem. It just right. helps you get to a yeah. place where you can think clearly enough to start to fix the problem.
I can quit, but cake's still going to be delicious. It's always going to be delicious.
But once you remove the cake, then you look around and go, oh, actually, cake was not my problem. Cake was the temporary band-aid of the fact that you have other emotional things or financial things. Like the thing is, when you drink a lot, sometimes you lose your job, you lose your partner, you lose your parents, you lose, you know.
But eating cake's not going to make you lose your job.
It might.
Depends.
Depends. And you think about those crazy hoarder people.
The cake is a lie.
The cake is a lie. Cake is not my downfall. And but the crazy thing about like hoarders. Like,
yeah, I love hoarders. Let's talk about it. One of my favorite programs on television.
Here's what I want them to do with hoarders. I want them to find a hoarder,
mm-hmm.
kidnap the hoarder,
okay.
burn their home to the ground.
I love it.
Find them some actual help and film none of it.
A lot of legal hurdles.
Here's what I think. It used to be called social services. Mm. It's gone now. And
is that a bit?
It should be, right?
Because that's really fucking funny. And yeah. film none of it.
None of it.
I was taking a sip of water when you said that, and I almost choked on it.
Yeah, it is now. It is a bit now.
That's really fucking funny.
Yeah, because I love a train wreck as much as the next person, right? You know?
I don't know. I love it the most, I think.
Really? When you see a train wreck, do you ever pull over and hope to find a foot?
Yes.
Yes, all right.
Any sort of body part. I'll collect it and bring it to the coroner.
Sure.
They can put it back with the body.
I
Right, it's not like you're... Yeah, but...
It is sort of funny that a lot of people that watch Hoarders and go, look at those crazy fucks, are a lot of times they're actually hoarding reality.
You bite your tongue.
They're hoarding reality shows. Mm-hmm. Reality content.
How's that DVR? Is it pretty loaded up?
Locked and loaded.
Loaded up with some hoarder crap?
It's not hoarding if it's digital.
Well, I don't.
You can't see it.
I don't like hoarding buried alive.
No.
But I like Hoarders.
You like the Hoarders
yeah,
show.
Yeah, there's a difference.
But they got pet hoarders now. They got...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You're hoarding pets.
I'm listening.
People who hoard pets who have more than.
Oh, I thought it was like a cat who hoarded a bunch of acorns.
Aw.
That would be adorable. Adorable.
That'd be the yeah. weirdest cat ever.
Adorable hoarders.
They're not really nut people.
I go.
Cats.
That's why it's a problem.
All right. Oh, I didn't see that.
They're
Good
hoarding
point.
Outside their.
Outside
their food chain.
Their food chain.
They're hoarding.
Outside their cartoon yeah. food likes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
The
lines are very blurred. It's blurred lines. So Robin Sixth is singing a song, and there's a bunch of naked cats with their tits out.
Oh my God! So I was at my high school reunion over the weekend, and this sums up my. I know.
I'm just imagining them just putting on blurred lines and enjoying it.
Oh no! I walked by Cindy Chubakowski. You don't know her. She just has the greatest name in the world,
sure.
Cindy Chubakowski. She was talking to Stefan Zygerowicz. I went to school with some Polish people.
Sure did.
And so I
really
because
I thought that was just Chewbacca's original name. I changed it to Chewbacca. It was Chubakowski.
It was Chubakowski. She was like, I needed to ethnic it up. And so she, I'm walking past her, and I just hear her say drunkenly and very passionately, "My favorite band will always be Foreigner." And I was like, I wished to God I could have remembered a Foreigner song. So
feels like the first time.
Cold as Ice, right? Mm-hmm. Jukebox Hero.
Yep.
There's some. I mean, and I'm not saying they aren't a perfectly good band.
I want to know what love is. Yep.
Urgent.
Fucking that's Lou so, Graham.
But there's something really genuinely adorable about that woman.
Yes, that's
holding
what,
on to Foreigner.
It was so beautiful. I was like,
Chubakowski. Really?
And that's what I said when I left. I was like, Chubakowski, you rock. Because it was. That's because we called each other by our last names in high school in the 12th century.
Chubakowski.
I know, that
you'll never
a
be a foreigner to us.
Well, I don't know if it happens now, but it happens quite a bit.
And then, so I put that on the Facebook group, right? Facebook group of my high school reunion, and it began a thread of people listing their favorite bands ever. And you know what came up more often than you would have thought it would have come up ever? Styx.
Really?
Nope. Out loud. I don't mind a couple of Styx songs, but I would never have said, my favorite band, Styx. It'd be like me saying, because what I did listen to in high school, a lot of Harry Chapin, talk about some sad, sad
sure.
music.
Oh, yeah.
Taxi,
yeah.
Cats in the Cradle.
Oh, my God. You know, the thing about Harry Chapin is that a lot of his songs were basically just these sad monologues with guitar playing.
The worst. Did you ever hear that song about the baby who died of starvation? I'm not even fucking kidding. It was like a 5-minute song about some African baby that dies of starvation. And all it is the last thoughts of the baby twang.
Oh.
And it's the worst. It's the worst.
Oh, he just fucking kicks your heart in.
And then he died, and that was an act of God. Because then he had to stop making music, and because it just got brutal.
When did you feel like when you first started comedy? Like, what type of stuff were you doing, and when did you start feeling like you were comfortable enough to start talking about, you know, video games and all these emotional stuff and personal stuff? Did it take you a long time to get to that?
It probably took me. You know, I started in the, I count the 80s as 1 year, just because in college I did stand up for 8 months. The club burned down. I didn't burn it down, but I got a 1.8 that semester. So it was probably for the best. And then I graduated from college and I moved to Minneapolis in 1990 and started doing stand up again.
Is that where you met Bamford?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's she was bald, and she had shaved her head and was playing the violin.
Like a prom dress or something, right?
Often she was dressed in some weirdo outfit, and then she had taken all these feminist stickers and put them all over her brand new Toyota Camry on the doors, the ceilings, the roof. I mean, I was like, why'd you ruin your car like that? That's a nice car. She was like, yeah, because I needed to tell the people what I believe. And I was like, you do that. Who bought that car? Your mom? Okay, I'll be over here being a dick. Anyway, so she was so fucking funny though, and but she played like, and for that first couple of years, she played the violin. But I started. I think the first jokes I did that were real were about my dad, right? And I can still go to the vault. I can go way to the back of the vault, pull a dad joke out from 1990, 1987, right? And but this more and more recently, I've just been trying to do. You know what's inspiring is Louis. You know, Louis's inspiring and Marin's inspiring because Marin. You know how Marin will be like, I'm going to open a vein. Would you like to open a vein with me? Yes. Yeah. Yes, I would. Of course I would. I'm going to show off. Yeah, I can open a vein even bigger than yours and or whatever. And so, but it, and the way Louis writes stuff, it's like such a weird part of his brain that is part of almost all of our brains, right? I mean, we can all relate to some of the weird shit that he's talking about at the very least, right? And it's just, I mean, it's inspiring to watch stuff about, I mean, I now have a hoarder's joke. I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to go there.
Well, yeah, I think what you're saying is that it's very hard to open up in comedy about real stuff and then not have people go, ooh, like, to get all sad, but still be able to tap into this place where you're basically just thumping people's brain and being like, this is a humanity thing.
Right, right. Like, I'm doing this new bit that, that needs work, but it's about how, because I'm married for the first time in my life and I'm having sex with the same person, not just random Ethiopian gentleman. But when you have sex with the same person more than once, right?
So glad he was a gentleman.
He was a gentleman and a scholar. But the thing, is I have sex with my husband. Sometimes, like, weird things have happened in my life because I never had a boyfriend, and I did stand-up comedy for 17 years. No boyfriend, just got laid occasionally. Felt pretty about it. We'd call it a tune-up. Anyway, Oh, yeah. Make it friends. So the thing is, hey, welcome to Nerdist, Too Much Information. But the thing about having sex with my husband on a regular basis, sometimes we'll be having sex, and he'll do something – that will trigger a horrible memory of something terrible that happened, because I used to ride the bus a lot. And let me tell you something about the bus. It isn't policed. And when you're 16 or 17, look around.
No!
Some woman is being, might be. Anyway, but the thing is he'll trigger something horrible, right? And then all of a sudden, he is fucking someone who's crying. And that isn't fun for either of us. Now, I have a couple of choices in this moment. I can stoically stare into the distance like it's some sort of porny Dickens novel from 1870 while he ruts. Or I can talk to him like a person, right? Right? Because he wants me to have a good time, right? Even the one-night stand guys wanted me to have a good time. I never had a, you know, whenever we would part ways, it'd be like, so that was fun, right? And I'm like, yeah, that was fun. Did you have fun? Yes, I had fun. And then we would go our way, our lives. But even those guys wanted it to be a good time, right? Everybody, nobody sure. doesn't want you to have a good time. How much more does my husband wish me to have a good time since we're doing it regularly?
For the long haul, yeah.
Yeah, and so I did. I said, boo-hoo. That reminded me of a sad thing, and that's why I'm crying. And he is a game designer. So he is like, well, how do we take back the night? Let's LARP this out, right? Let's fix it. He's like, we will role play this and we'll fix it. We'll fix it in post, right? Or whatever. And he's just like,
so right now, this level's boss is your sadness.
Exactly. And he can beat it. That's nice. I like that, man.
Yes,
all right,
please.
Thank you. Because we set up a couple of chairs. He's like, we'll set up a couple of chairs in the kitchen. We'll pretend we're on the bus. And then we'll reenact the horrible thing. And then at the end of it, you'll be fucking me. And you like me. My favorite line. And then...
Oh,
and it totally
wonderful.
Worked. It worked. It totally fucking worked.
Really?
And I was like, oh, this is awesome. Because, you know, like, I don't know. And I've tried that bit like 4 or 5 times now, right? And there's more to it. But the thing is women have come up to me after shows and go, oh my God, that has totally happened to me with my current boyfriend or lover or partner or whatever, and husband. And they're just like, and I never know how to talk to them about it because it's not them. I just, you know, there's a third choice. You can stoically sort of just go, it isn't him. It isn't him. This isn't the horrible person. This is the good person. You can do that. But that, you're never going to come with that mantra. That's not the mantra that helps you come, right?
Says you.
Yeah, unfortunately, your lizard brain's the gatekeeper there.
Right. It does not. Yeah, it doesn't.
Now I feel like there could be some sort of Mr. Show sketch where your husband is like a former game designer used all the knowledge from designing games to figuring out how to fix his relationship partners. His book is called Coding Pussy.
Oh! Could be it very easily. That's hilarious, because the thing is, I mean, it depends what your job is, right? I mean,
well, okay, listen, if you're a game designer, if you're coding, mm-hmm. you have to understand how to get from this point to this point.
Right.
And you have to walk through all the steps. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure that all of the code is perfect.
Right.
You have to... justify everything that happened mathematically.
Yep.
And to get this result.
Right. He is not a coder. That would be how he would do it if he were a coding guy.
He
totally.
Just, okay.
He's a game mechanic guy. So he sees, he's like, so we want to, and everything's got to be fun. He's like, how do I make the game fun? So how do I make the puzzle fun? What's the game mechanic to make this enjoyable for everyone?
How do I make this crying puzzle fun?
Yes. How do I fix the crying puzzle? How do I turn this sad face upside down? And well, I'll tell you how you do it in middle management of justice. There's a TV room. Okay. that you have to upgrade. Anyway.
So it worked.
So it works. Yeah. So, I mean, the thing. I mean,
what a great guy.
He's a great guy, and it's a great bit, right? Because it's a serious sort of issue.
It is, because it's one of what's lovely about it is it's one of those bits where as you're laughing, you're going, I don't know if I'm supposed to be laughing at this, but
right.
I can't stop laughing.
Right, that seems sad that sad things happen, but now they're fixed, and yay. And then other people are like, oh my God, I'm trying that. Because I've had women come up to me and go, yeah, we're doing that. We're going to reenact the crime. And then at the end of it, we're going to be sleeping with the people that we like.
So how was What was the thing at the end that made it okay? Was there any sort of...
Well, you know how... Okay, you know, I don't know if this happens. I mean, it has to happen to guys, right? But I don't, I'm only living this life.
Yeah, sure, we'll help you out.
Yeah, you're guys. Mm-hmm. And so, but the when you do things that are... that when bad things happen, like mm-hmm. like if you're touched in an inappropriate way, if a bad situation happens, and then for some reason... you were to get a hard on, and then you're like, "Well, I know this isn't right. I know this isn't right. Why am I getting a hard on?"
Because it's anchored to the, it's emotionally anchored to the thing.
It's emotionally anchored to the terrible thing or the weird thing that happened, and then so
you're feeling both things at the same time,
right? And you're just like, "I have a vague, sick feeling in my stomach, even though I am super turned on."
As if this neural pathway was created that you does not. It's just, it's almost like a physical. Thing
it's very lizardy.
Yes, it's very lizardy, and it's connected in a way where it's like, oh, these two emotions are happening because they're connected to the same circuit.
Right. And so what the game mechanic did was to recreate the bad situation, but with a right person. So it rotated the situation, you know? Like I had a massage on Venice Beach. Used to do a long bit about it. And the guy was fingering me while he was giving me this massage. And
right in the old,
that's where I keep my vagina.
Yeah.
That's the punchline.
Yep.
And then I had to say, hey, that's where I keep my vagina. You're going to move to the other leg. But what really happened, because ladies don't always speak up, is I tipped him. I got off the fucking table and I tipped him. Yeah. Yeah,
extra,
that's what I did.
More or less than you would have
exactly
previously.
The same amount. No notice.
No special
nothing.
Treatment.
No special treatment. Just going to keep moving. Here's $10. Got to go. And so whenever I'm getting a massage, I can sometimes get sexually aroused. Way too much info, internet, and but the thing is you want to take that back, right? I mean, you want to A, be able to enjoy massages, and B, enjoy being fingered,
right?
And C, enjoy all sexual activity, right?
Of course.
Right, so to bring all those three things together, there has to. I mean, let there be a new story written over. The story of creepy Mr. Lee on the Venice boardwalk.
Now, so if I do this with your husband, am I going to enjoy being fingered? Because I don't.
Maybe.
I've
maybe
never.
We'll, you have your own journey. It's like, is you know when you're in the treehouse with your buddy from high school or whatever. I don't know.
So fascinating.
It's so. I mean, it's you know. I mean, whether
all men's sexual discoveries happen in a treehouse
or camp, whatever. You know, you're at the stables, and there's a trough.
Look at that mare.
You're visiting the farm. Somebody picks up a duck. It's but the it's. I mean,
let's see if this corkscrew thing is true.
You never know. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't have any boy comparisons.
That's really interesting. So he creates new emotional associations.
Right, right. I'm sure that there will be a Ryan Gosling movie made about it.
He's.
All be...
You know, I gotta tell you how that he's very brave to do that because he's basically. Telling you to stare something in the face, which runs the risk of potentially ruining you forever if it hits the wrong way, right?
Oh, he believes in himself as a game designer. That's an excellent point. But I think, it takes bravery on everybody's part.
Well,
to
there's no question on your part because you have to feel the thing again.
I have to feel the thing again, and I have to admit to the thing, right? First, you have to, because it is, there is part, I have... just cried and stared off into the distance, right? I mean, there is a time when you can just suck it up and go, this will be over in a couple of minutes. It'll be fine. And you can do that. But there's being in a relationship is the bravest thing I've ever done in my life. I have never been in a relationship before. I had a weird boyfriend in high school, college rather, for like a year. And I was mean to him, and then eventually we broke up. And so...
Sounds about right.
And then, because it's your first... I didn't know what I was doing. And so, and I've apologized. But the thing
did
is,
you apologize to him at the reunion?
I apologized to him. I see him. He's a comic.
Oh.
Anyway, because we started doing stand-up together.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
Because that's what you want to do with your first
sure.
So he doesn't know Chubakowski.
He doesn't know Chubakowski. Ah. But the...
His loss.
But yeah, I mean, it's... But to be in any relationship, like the sort of the honesty that it takes and the reality, you know, I've had many, many roommates where you're like, well, do your chores and, you know, you make sure you're polite and, you know, respect each other's space and this stuff. So that's how I went into the relationship. I was like, oh, so it'll be a roommate with perks, right? We'll get to have sex and he hugs me.
We'll split the bills
me.
And do it.
Yeah. And then we'll get to do it.
Yeah.
We'll roll around like puppies. play games, and good times. And so it was a unique way to go into having any sort of relationship. And he was like, I love it. I love this politeness and this sort of roommate sort of gentility. You know, there's a gentility to it that we're doing that I don't know, because I've seen other people have relationships one after another, and it doesn't seem to be. Like, my first thing, even when I had shitty roommates, we were polite, you know? Yeah. I mean, just don't be a, you know, there's, nobody wants impolite roommates. And so, and then you try to keep the common areas clean, and you know? Because Andy did say to me, we were like, and this is a bit that I do, which is, but it's true, is 3 months into dating, he said, it's great you've never really had a boyfriend because you don't have any expectations of me. And I said, I have expectations of you. And he said, what are your expectations? And I said, well, I expect you to be nice. I expect you to be polite. I expect that if we ever live together, you'll keep the common areas clean and that you will do your half of the chores. And he said, yeah, those are roommate expectations. Those are not boyfriend expectations. And I said, well, what are boyfriend expectations? And he goes, you don't need to know. So, you know.
I'm not going to tell you.
It'll be fine. And then I will bring, nice things will happen and you will be happy. And nice things happen and I'm happy. So.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, first of all, it's interesting that that you went through that and figured out that you could work through it in that way. But it's also interesting that you're talking about it too, because it.
Yeah,
I think maybe
that's the hardest part. That was the hardest part.
Is talking about
first
it
time
on,
I talked about it
on
yeah.
stage.
Yeah,
because you have a very. You talk really fast and you have a very upbeat manner on stage.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think there's almost something with the swiftness with the way that you're presenting material that it doesn't sit long enough for people to be like, oh, wait a minute. You know, like they're just hearing it and it's,
right.
you know, like, because you're just like skimming it.
Right. Well, you know, I did the show up in Montreal and whoever was timing my set said, well, you're not leaving any time for laughs. You got to cut like 2 minutes out. And I said, they can laugh later. It'll be fine. Everybody's got a DVR. Just rewind it and watch it again. It'll be fine.
They can laugh.
Remember when I did that thing at Outside Lands with you?
Yeah.
And I had those two bits were at that time 16 minutes. It was 2 8-minute bits. And I'd been given 12 minutes and I did 14. And I got off stage and you were like, Jesus, you talked fast.
It was
unbelievable. I said, I had to get those. I had to finish those jokes.
I mean, like, yeah, because especially near the end, you're like, okay, all right, okay. Like, and it was just
bam, 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 bam. And then this happened, and this happened, and this happened.
And people start laughing, almost like, shut up, just listen, I have to get through this.
Yeah, and then you can laugh later. It'll be fine. Buy the album. Buy the published works. It'll all work out.
Are you on the road a lot right now?
I am. I am on the road a lot, but and it's good. Thank you, God, I'm working a lot, which is good. I'm home for about a week right now, and then I go to Tucson, and then I go to San Francisco to do like a weird live Dork Forest and thing again. So and
Dork Forest is your podcast that if people don't know, they should know about it. I've done it. A lot of people have
done it. You've done it, yeah. Fred Armisen just did it this week,
and I remember the bit that title came from.
The
Dork Forest was the war reenactment bit.
The war reenactment. How deep into the Dork Forest do you have to go to get to the war reenactment, guys?
You have to go past the Beanie Baby people.
Yes.
You have to go past the oh fuck.
I have to say it all fast if I'm going to do it. It's like you got to go by the Beanie Baby people, the Renaissance Fair folks. That I forgot it.
Dork Forest and then
Harry Potter himself. And to get to the war reenactment guys, who I won't hang out with anymore. How sad is that? When I moved here, that's what happened. I moved here and I met these guys who were World War II reenactment guys. And that was the line. That was the straw.
You never see World War II reenactments.
Yeah, it's the worst idea ever. There's still people alive from that one.
Because you can just go talk to someone who was
there. Yeah,
why don't
you go talk to an old guy? Yeah. I'm doing. And then the tagline was, I'm going to do a Vietnam War protesters reenactment group. We're just going to get stoned and pretend we're making a difference.
Oh, they already did that. It was called the, what the fuck, Wall Street? Occupy Wall Street.
Occupy Wall Street.
No, it's the entire generation of 57-year-old guys who drive Escalades. That's what that Occupy was just the next generation of that. It's fine.
They'll drive Teslas.
And so you've been doing Dork Forest for a while now.
Yeah, 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Getting in on the ground floor of podcasting is not as profitable as getting in on the ground floor of plastics. It's a Wonderful Life reference. But it is really, it remains super fun, right? Because it can be the, because I talk to people about what they dork out about, right? Moshe Kasher's in the next one.
Great.
He loves religion. And so we talk religion for an hour.
He texted me the other day asking me if I had read the parable of the sower. And I'm like, do you mean from the New Testament? He's like, yeah. And I was like, why? He's like, I'm trying to get some books on tape and I want to know if it's any good. I'm like, it's the you fucking might. Bible.
If someone, if someone says to me, have you heard the parable of, I'll go, well, I'll just stop you right there. I haven't read it. Although I did, I mean, I had to take theology in Catholic school too, to take theology.
Oh, that, I forgot about that. 3 weeks ago, my brother, my oldest brother's an evangelist, and he calls me 3 weeks ago. He says, hey, I'm publishing a new version of the Bible.
What?
You What's know, a new a, version?
Well, he said, it's going to be easier. It's going to be easier to read. And I'm like, you're just highlighting things that you believe?
So all the Gospels are 140 characters or less.
Well, you know, because there's lots of people doing tweets. New versions. Like the Good News. Remember the Good News from back in the day? The King James. Those are all King versions James of the Bibles, sure, yeah. Right? But I was just like, and my brother Terry is an evangelist, and he's just a piece of work, right? And so I was telling my dad, and I said, what, Terry? What are you doing? And he goes, I'm calling you to tell you a nice thing. And I said, I'm sorry. What's happening? And he goes, I wrote a foreword to the Old Testament. And I was like, okay, stop talking. You have balls the size of Gibraltar.
You can't write a foreword before the Old Testament because forewords haven't been invented yet in the Old Testament.
You know what I said? I said, you know that the Old Testament is the foreword to the thing that you believe. And he was like, I am trying to tell you a nice thing. A lady from Harvard really liked it. And I was like, "That congratulations. Is there going to be a picture of you on the cover?
She doesn't go there. She was hanging out in front of it.
I went the high road in the Harvard thing, and I did not make fun of the Harvard thing.
I will say this right now. It's not a terrible idea. Your brother will make money.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
There's a picture of him on the cover, pressed against the glass ceiling.
He'll be just fine.
There's just one job that he's looking for. Yeah. It's going to be great.
Yep.
So what is the foreword of the...
I don't know. I'm going to Tucson next week, and he lives in Tucson.
Oh.
Yeah. And I always have one lunch with him. One lunch.
Back.
That's all I can do. That's all I can do. One lunch.
Does he tell you...
he homeschooled his kids. He has a GED.
I have a family like that.
So basically, it's not your problem with him is not that he's a very religious person. It's just that he is a very, he tells you how to.
He's the biggest bossy fucking Magoo of religion, is my problem with him. It is not that he has found the Jesus. It is the Jesus that he found. It is, I got some Jesus. I'm not above the Jesus. My Jesus is not as grumpy or as concerned with what is going inside people's hoo-has as his Jesus. And you know, he's the easiest guy to rebel against. He's got four kids, and they're all beautiful children, very nice, but they all rebelled against him in some way or another.
So they all share different Jizai.
Right, their Jizai. His oldest daughter is dating a Muslim guy, and he's a very nice man, and I hope that she's not just, and I know that she's not just dating him because he's Muslim, but I mean, I think it was part of it.
So he's not, so your brother's not thrilled?
No, and he's not thrilled that our sister is gay. And like he, I called him to tell him that my sister and her girlfriend had a science baby, right? They have a couple of them now, and so I called everyone.
little Carl Sagan,
and I was like, hey, Daryl and Sam had a baby. You should call or send a card or send a dollar and do something. Be a human. And so I'm calling to tell everybody. And Terry's like, well, you know, I can't call. All I can do is pray for that child.
Oh, no!
Yeah, yeah. And I said, you're right. You shouldn't call. You shouldn't call. And he goes, well, you know the church saved me, and it made me a better man. And I said, yeah, that did make you a better man. I just wish you were a better man than you are. Because I am a dick sometimes. I was like, I'm...
I'd say called for.
I was so mad. I was like, you are so rude. I can't even talk to you.
So does he not have a relationship with your other sister at all?
No. Nobody has any relationships with anybody. They all have J-cation. They're like, hey, how's Nancy doing? How's Dad doing? How's Terry doing?
Taking
how's
a J-cation.
I'm taking a J-cation. And I know. I got three siblings living in Minneapolis right now. So they talk to each other. And then I got a brother who lives in Milwaukee. He talks to them occasionally and around them to me. And he talks to me. And then our dad lives in Milwaukee. And then my brother Terry... He calls occasionally, I mean, very rarely, but mostly talks through me to find out what the hell's going on with them.
Wow.
Wow.
Yep.
And
that means is I have to talk to all of them. which can be exhausting.
Do you have to?
I do not. I do not. This is a complete and entire choice on my part. Because I do love them. And that's a new bit I want to work on about unconditional love and how it feels unconditional only if you're forced to hang out with people. Like my cousins, I wouldn't hang out with people that I'm related to. We wouldn't be friends. And I might miss things because of it, right?
Right.
But I probably wouldn't know most of my siblings unless we were related, and I would miss some of the cool things that they do and are, but I would also have other friends. So it's weird.
So are you pretty unique in your family? I mean, just in terms of the things that you're into and the stuff that you're about, is it literally like 4 or 5 different points of view, or is there a cluster of people that are very similar and then some outliers?
Well, I've decided recently that we're all, to some extent, patterned after my father's button-pushing career. My father's a giant button-pusher, right? And it's a learned skill. Like, what he wants to do is irritate you just short of you punching him.
Yeah.
And that, as a learned skill, means that he has been punched. Because you go too far. And then you get, like, I was 9 years old, and I come out to breakfast one morning, and he's been beat up. He's got a black eye, fat lip. And I'm like, what happened, Dad? I'm 9. I'm reading a lot of Louis L'Amour at the time. And he goes, I won the argument, lost the fight. The guy knocked him down, and he said, so Frank Pulaski punches me, knocks me down. He's kicking again with the poles. He's kicking me. And I said, he kicked you when you were down? That's not fair. And he goes, no, that's what you do. That's what you do when they're down, because then they don't get up. And I was like, even when you're on the bad end of terrible life choices, you're still supportive. And he's like, well, that's what you do. I'm not saying.
So when he was down there, was he like, I support what you're doing.
That makes sense. I'd be doing that. Oh, God.
Oh, make sure and get my ribs. Let me just lean this way a little bit so you can crack my windpipe.
Oh, that was solid.
If you knock the wind out of me, you're right. I will not get up. Then you can walk away and I can just
feel
crawl
being
out of
right
here.
Never felt so good.
Yeah, so they're all very successful. It's interesting about my family is that everybody's super successful and good at what they do, and we were raised in such a haphazard ways that it makes me laugh to just, like, my brother is an evangelist. He has his GED, but he has 4 children and a house and a beautiful wife and a following, a bunch of sheep. I mean, he's got people who listen to him. Bossy Magoo them. And then my second oldest brother has 4 children, and he's a print salesman. He's very successful. And my third oldest brother's a commodities broker and is very successful. And my fourth oldest brother is an econ professor and has 2 children. And my sister is a financial advisor. But, you know, half of them are very conservative and half of them are very liberal. And I can give up. Like, I always think that my conservative brothers and my dad are just saying it not because they believe it, but just to be button pushers. But that possibly could be naive.
Or it could just be,
wishful thinking.
Maybe it's a little bit of both. Maybe it's a little bit on your side and a little bit on their side.
You know, my dad, here's a joke that nobody's ever gotten. There's 3 people in the world who laugh at this when I try this one, which is that my dad hasn't voted since 1972. McGovern. He voted for McGovern. And I asked him why one time, and he said, well, because neither party's on my side. Why should I vote for either of them? I was like, are you an ent? My father is an ent.
Yes, but then you need to see all his brothers being slaughtered by orcs.
Yeah, and then he will rise to the occasion.
Yes.
He always wants everyone to do well. It's not that he doesn't want everyone to do well. He just doesn't understand why everyone doesn't. Like, he's like the kind of guy who's like, well, if you aren't happy, why don't you just do something that makes you happy?
Right.
And you're like, Dad, that's simplistic. And yet people do not do it. He said, I'm not saying change your life fundamentally. I'm saying go get yourself a sprinkle cake or, you know, go get yourself a pinky ring, which is what he did.
So what do you think, where do you see, when did the album, has the album come out yet or it's about to come out?
No, I'm recording it. It's going to be called This Is, I want it to be called, the label doesn't like the title, but I'm doing it all myself anyway, so I get to call it whatever the fuck I want. And it is, This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux. Is the name
Fantastic.
Of my next album, and I'm recording it and a DVD in December at Acme.
Oh, you're recording it? You're actually recording in Acme. That's
great. Yeah, that's where I always record, just because it's my home club, and Lewis is very, very supportive.
Lewis Lee, it's a great room.
It's a great room. It's in Minneapolis, and he's almost more supportive of my career than me.
Yeah.
You know, my mother used to say, my favorite comedian, Norm Macdonald. And I was like, you know, I do stand-up comedy. And then, and my dad, and she was like, it's a given. And I said, it would be if you didn't say Norm MacDonald quite so much. And then my dad's favorite comic, Maria Bamford.
Really?
Oh, yeah, but that's just because it's his favorite kind of, the tiny blonde woman in her mid-30s is when he met her. And he's like, oh, she's cute. He hit on her at my wedding.
Really?
Yes. And
so Maria fucked your dad.
No, she said it was actually pretty good because my father hits on women. It's all just a cold call. It's a numbers game for
him. She put her hand on his leg and he came.
Oh, creepy, 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 creepy. Well played, well played.
Thank you.
She said that it was just essentially, he just stood there and was like, and she got this sort of weird vibe from him, like, I think you're pretty. If you were to want to be in on this, you could be in on this. And it was all incredibly standoffish, but she said, I felt good about myself, and yet I could turn him down, and he took it. And I told him that, because, you know, everybody needs a shot in the arm.
Yeah.
You know, Dad, you still got the good moves. It didn't work. And he goes, oh, yeah, she doesn't have the right father issues. My father said that about my friend. And I said, do you have a laminated list, Dad, of what are the correct father issues as you are my father? Maria did write the greatest joke about my dad. She said, wow, you're officially too old for your father ever to molest. And I told him that joke and he laughed, which means everyone else gets to, because my father is a jackass. He's not broken.
Well, you and Maria were on the road together a lot, right? You were actually opening for Maria
I'll open for Maria anytime, day or night, because it is a treat to watch Maria Bamford. Someone asked me the other day, what's it like being best friends with Maria Bamford? And I said, it's like being best friends with Hermione Granger. That is the 13th reference to the Harry Potter books that we've had here at The Nerdist. But
did
when
you see my stand-up special? Like 14 of
yes!
those.
Yes! Yeah. And
I'm like, really, am I going to do this again? Yep, this is
yep,
where my brain's
we're
going.
We're
doing it.
And but because when you're best friends with Hermione, you spend a lot of time in the library.
Yep.
When you're best friends with Maria Bamford, all you do is work on your comedy. That's all we do. We play joke machine back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And she one time, and I only did it once. It's exhausting. It turns out she wants to do 20-minute chunks at each other.
Oh my God!
We did it for 2 hours. 2.5 hours. And I was like, well, I'm exhausted. I got to take a nap.
Did it work?
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. I mean, the thing is that night the shows were amazing. I mean, they were amazing shows. When you get to work on the exact wording and someone is just attentively going, yeah, yeah, that's, you know, and then tweaking words and helping
God
you out.
God damn it. You know, do you watch Breaking Bad at all?
I have tried. It isn't going to get any better. That's what I noticed when the doll fell into the pool.
Right.
Decisions are not going to be made that I'm ever going to. I already know people making bad life.
Yeah, it chips away at your soul.
Yeah,
in terms
a little
of
bit.
Like, oh,
a little bit.
Why would they do that?
Why would you start over?
Well, there's one. This isn't too much of a spoiler, but there's a part where they need a bunch of meth, so they just take a camper into the desert and they just spend all weekend making as much meth as possible.
Oh,
and
right.
So I watched that and I was like, I should do that with jokes. Why don't I just go into the middle of the fucking nowhere and just write for 48 hours?
Well, because you don't want to do it. I mean, some people can do that. Like bands do that, right? Don't they? And there's joke machine. There's one rule of joke machine. Someone tells you a premise. Someone tells you a joke idea, you have to say there's something there. You can't go, no, too creepy. You can't talk about like the sexual, weird sexual thing that was coming up. Maria was like, yeah, there's something there. And like the weirdest thing, like my dad, I go to my high school reunion this weekend and I call Maria. So I was like, so my dad said to me before, he said, well, you should lie and tell him you're in a bunch of movies and stuff. And I was like, Dad, my career is going just fine. Why do I have to lie? And he's like, well, you're just to make it a nicer thing. And I was like, everybody has an iPhone, Dad. They're going to, why would I?
It's easily verifiable.
And I was just on Conan. What do you need from me? And Maria was like, oh, you got to do something about that. And I was like, oh, that's too depressing. She said, just wait. So that's what you do. I mean, you just try jokes back and forth. And we'll only do that for like, see, the 20-minute chunks at each other, that was brutal. I was like, what it usually is it's usually at 45 minutes, half an hour to an hour of just back and forth, just working on bits. Mm-hmm. And then that's fine. You know, then you can work on the thing and you're like, I got a new angle on this.
How the fuck do you work on bits with Maria, though? Or you too, actually, where it's, well, I guess with you, you're coming up with like descriptors and ways to frame things. But Maria is so, can you even give her jokes? Because it all just seems like.
I give her angles and I can tag stuff.
Okay.
And so, and which is what she does. She can give me a different angle to come from and a tag sometimes. And yeah, it's like the she's got this great thing about how her parents are so cheerful. They're so grateful in their twilight years. They're like, it's almost like they're high, where they're just wandering around going, oh my God, the blue of this shirt is so, it's stunning on you. It is beautiful. And she's like, what are you doing? What are you taking? And it's, but it's much longer than that. And then she'll whittle it down to something manageable. But it's, yeah, I mean, the you know, she's just like, what do you, it's more, what do you think of this idea? What do you think of this phrasing?
Yeah.
And then the practice of the phrasing back and forth. So.
So are you, let's see, this will, you're recording the album at the end of the year. So that'll be out next year. And then hopefully you'll take a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
Before you start.
Yeah. It'd be nice. I'd like to, there's that, the one thing, I've never wanted to go on a cruise in my life, but I want to go on that cruise up to Alaska to see the glaciers before they go away.
Oh, yeah, oh, shit.
but they're good, though.
Before they break up.
Right, before they break up. Yep. The band.
One last before they break up. Yeah, I'm going to go see the glaciers.
I'm going to go see the.
They're great.
Yeah, they're great. I understand.
Great band.
They're leaving.
It's after their farewell
this.
Tour.
I saw the Great Barrier Reef. They told me that it was going to break up, and turns out it's still there.
Still right there.
Still there.
Well, Jackie Cation, Dork Force is your podcast, and you're at Jackie Cation on
Chris, Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you for being here, Jackie Cation. It's always a pleasure. And congratulations on all the stand-up success that's happening. And I really...
Thank you.
Do you feel... So your recording is still like three and a half months away. Do you feel
I have 25 tight minutes. I need another 35 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
I
know that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's fine. I mean, if it isn't that audience that was there at open mic, they might be more forgiving. And maybe I stick all that 35 in the middle and I bookend it.
Yeah. 25, yeah. What you could do is you could do 12 and a half, and then you have Bamford come out, and you guys do two 20 minutes at each other.
Do a thing.
And then you, then you have a leave stage, and you do your last 12 and a half minutes.
The audience is on their feet. And, they just shot a DVD there. I'm sorry, I'm going to keep talking. Bent Washburn just talked, just did his. Do you know that guy, Bent Washburn?
At Akron? I don't know if I know.
He's from Utah originally. He's a lapsed Mormon. He's genuinely one of the funniest guys. And he is in such a groove right now. He probably gets sad at open mics too. And he was like, they didn't love it. But he has this awesome... I saw a rough cut of the DVD because they shot it there, and David Crowe directed it, and they set up some sort of weird. What's that? Where you sit on something and the camera zooms towards the gate, the stage, a dolly.
Yeah,
it's just called a dolly. Well, so I thought it was going to be fancier.
What's that dolly like thing?
What's that hand truck thing where you just sit on and somebody pushes you?
It's a dolly.
It's like a ride.
Dolly.
Okay.
No, that's not it.
Dolly train.
It's a camera scooter.
Camera zoom.
Yeah.
It's a camera zoom scooter thing, and then. But yeah, it looked really good, and I'd love him to do it, but I don't know who's going to do it yet. We're still months out.
What day does Dork Forest come out each week?
Tuesdays, dorkforest.com. It's part of the All Things Comedy networky podcast thing.
Tuesdays with Jackie.
Awesome. How many episodes have you done
Tuesdays,
at this
point? Tuesdays, TDF. I did 200 episodes with shitty recording where it was just a conference call. And they sound a lot like the Red Fox album from 1969. You can hear the jokes, and that's on a weird RSS feed that you gotta come find me, and then the last 200 episodes are pre-recorded crystal, and they're just at dorkforest.com. So I'm at a little over 400.
Nice.
Yeah, it's nice. I was doing two a week, and then people were like, "Hey, podcast just blew up. Why don't you keep it to one?" And I said, "Less work. I'm in." So
great.
So I only do two.
She was doing two a week before it was cool.
I was doing all of it before it was cool.
That's true.
Shit,
and you know what
yeah.
it was? You know what? It wasn't even cool.
Before it was a thing, an actual thing.
Yeah, and I just heard about it. I think it was at the Gypsy. I genuinely do think a guy said, "Hey, I'm doing a podcast," and I said, "Well, what the hell is that?" 2005, and he said, "Well, you just call in, and then the internet records it." That's what he said. The internet records it, and then it just goes up to iTunes, and you don't have to do anything.
Shit.
And I said, and I am in on that. That sounds like fun. It was just, I was just going to do, and then the Dork Forest name, I just needed a name. And I was like, people, that kind of resonated with people. So, and now it's got a life of its own.
That's great. Well, I'd love to come back.
Please do.
I will
come back
to the Dork Forest.
Excellent. All Attainable right. goal.
Enjoy your burrito. Enjoy thy burrito as ye weary traveler.
quests through the dark forest looking for World War II reenactment people from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
If we leave, we'll just keep doing that.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.